This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoen. President Obama said at a town hall-style meeting last Friday that he was modestly optimistic that Washington could come up with an immigration deal this year. The U.S. Senate already passed a bill that would lead to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants if they abided by a number of provisions. The process would take more than a decade. Last week, House Republicans introduced a set of principles on immigration that could lead to legal status. Immigration reform has been a contentious issue for years, which is one of the reasons that some states are taking matters into their own hands. Today in Radio Times, we discuss reform efforts, the debate over legalization, and what's happening here in the Commonwealth. And we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Michael Matza is the Philadelphia Inquirer's staff writer on immigration, a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist. And Michael Matza, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Mary.
Also with us is Peter Spiro. He holds the Charles Wiener Chair in International Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. A former law clerk to retired Justice David Souter wrote a book a couple of years ago called Beyond Citizenship. And Peter Spiro, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here, Marty.
You know, I was thinking about Ronald Reagan going back to the 1980s, was able to pass immigration reform, but we don't seem to have been able to do much since then. Peter, why do you think that is?
I think it all comes down to the Republicans in the House of Representatives and the politics of immigration at the district level. Republicans now are more worried about primary fights. They're more worried about attacks from the right than they are about the Hispanic vote. And so that's really been the obstacle. We had a bill out of the Senate, which would have provided for a large-scale legalization program and a path to citizenship. But I think it really comes down to the House, and we're seeing some movement, so I think there's some promise for this session of Congress.
What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I certainly would agree with that. And you know, not even 2 years ago, the Republicans were the party of self-deportation. Rick Perry was fighting with Mitt Romney because in Texas they had a DREAM Act, and he had to sort of explain that. Now you've got New Jersey, where Governor Christie has just signed a DREAM Act, and the Republicans, Christie has had his problems on other issues lately, but the Republicans are like leaning into this issue now as opposed to pushing it away.
But do you think it's all the Republicans' fault, Michael?
No, I think there's a lot that's broken with our immigration system. It's not driven only by partisan politics. You've got long backlogs for people who want legal visas. You've got problems bringing in enough workforce to work in our farm industries and stuff like that.
Peter, it's interesting even to look at the U.S., the Senate bill, which was passed. But when you look at all the requirements for citizenship, it's something like a 13-year process. And one wonders whether how many people would do that, assuming it were to become some version of the law, and whether it would make a difference in their lives.
Well, it's a 13-year track to citizenship, but the track to legal status is only a year. And so that really is the prize, I think, or that's the key. That's what undocumented aliens want. There's a recent poll from Pew in which a majority of Hispanic respondents said that was more important than citizenship, legal status. And so, I think citizenship has complicated the picture a little bit. And really, a lot of it's just about legal status. And we've seen movement in the last week where President Obama did not use the phrase path to citizenship in the State of the Union. And so there's the possibility, I think, for maybe some compromise short of citizenship. And that, I think, would progress. That maybe is how the logjam is going to be broken here.
And in fact, Michael, that's how some of the Republicans in the House are talking, including John Boehner.
Yes, because immigrants have shown that protection from deportation is higher on the list for them than citizenship. Their families often get broken apart when some member gets deported. And so legalization is more important, really, to them initially. The question really is going to be whether the president has said in the past that he wants this ultimately to lead to citizenship. He doesn't want two classes of people in this country. And so that's where the compromise is going to have to come.
But let's assume for argument's sake, Peter, that legal status becomes the law. I mean, would it create two classes of what, Americans?
So that's the problem, I think, from the Democrat side, is that as a matter of principle, it's really alien to our constitutional ethos to have this second-class status without the possibility of citizenship. And so that's a tough principle to compromise on. And I think maybe the thinking is that we could think of this in a two-step process, that let's get this huge population of undocumented aliens legalized, because that is what's more important to them on a sort of day-to-day basis. And then down the road, citizenship can be put into play.
How does Pennsylvania, Michael, look at this issue of undocumented immigrants? And we're not a border state, so it's I think, a different conversation.
Right.
But what are you hearing?
In terms of the percentages of people who are foreign-born in Pennsylvania, it's much lower than the nation as a whole, and certainly much lower than places like California and Arizona. And yet it's still an issue. They are here, and they are in our economy. We have a state representative, Daryl Metcalf, who has a very high profile on this issue, despite the fact that Pennsylvania is not, the biggest state for immigration. He's got an organization, State Legislators for Legal Immigration, I think it's called. And so Pennsylvania, because of him and his organization, plays a bigger role than it ordinarily would, given its numbers, I think.
Well, here's a quote from one of the articles that you wrote from Daryl Metcalf. As you describe him, Pennsylvania's most vocal critic of illegal immigration said the proposals advancing rights for people have no right to be in on our soil in the first place. He's basically saying they shouldn't be here and they should have no rights because they are here.
Yeah.
And is he for deportation? Or what do you do about millions of people that live within a country?
Well, I think, what he has done in the past and others in this area have done is make the state inhospitable, and either they'll leave or they'll find it impossible to sort of survive. And that, I think, has been the approach. What you've got now is, and states started copycatting that. It started in Arizona, and then it started in South Carolina, but now you've got copycat states going the other way,
exactly.
picking in-state tuition for students and things like that. So it's been interesting. The states have been frustrated by the lack of final activity by the federal government on this, and so they've stepped up into it.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, very, very interesting developments, and I think the balance is tipping in favor of immigrant interests on this. So the SB 1070 experience out of Arizona and the HB 56 out of Alabama, very bad for those states, both in terms of tarnishing their brands, but also in terms of damaging their economies. And so there actually haven't been that many copycats in the wake of the experience of those two states. And then, as Michael points out, on the other hand, you've got states extending benefits to undocumented immigrants, in-state tuition, municipal IDs. You have states resisting cooperation with the federal government in immigration enforcement. So we're old enough to remember the sanctuary movement from the 1980s and 90s. Now, that's been snuffed out by federal legislation, but there have been sort of lesser forms of resistance. There's something called the Trust Act out of California, under which California has rejected the federal secure communities initiative, and so there's been very interesting movement in favor of protecting this group of aliens who don't have status yet.
In fact, I remember stories from a couple of summers ago, and I'm not sure which state it was. It might have even been in Pennsylvania, where farmers were saying, they didn't have enough field workers to harvest crops.
A congressional lobbyist for the farm industry was speaking last week at the University of Pennsylvania with former Governor Rendell and former Governor Haley Barbour as part of a bipartisan policy center initiative to accomplish immigration reform. And what she said was that 70% of the workforce is falsely documented, despite the fact that the farmers are supposed to check to make sure people are authentically in this country, that they recognize that about 70% of their workforce is falsely documented. And when there's a raid, they lose a lot of, a law enforcement raid, they lose a lot of those people. And as a result, the farm industry wants a guest worker program as part of this immigration reform that would give stability to their labor force. And she pointed out that domestic, you know, people born here do not apply for those jobs. The issue is always, why should we give jobs when there's a high unemployment and stuff like that? In the farm industry, they do not get those workers.
Well, and I wonder, Peter, whether it's a kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, which is, and by that I mean there are undocumented immigrants living in this country. There's a lot of talk about either deporting them or doing something about them. But when it comes to harvesting crops, for instance, you know, 70% of them are undocumented.
And so immigrants do many jobs that U.S. citizens and those who are here legally refuse to do.
And we know that,
right? We know that. And Alabama was a very dramatic instance of the sort of crops being left to rot on the vine. Business interests have been very, very interested in getting reform. And I think that's one factor that makes this politically plausible, is that this traditional Republican constituency, this Wall Street Journal crowd, is very much in favor of adopting a comprehensive immigration reform.
I mean, it's interesting. There was Haley Barbour and Ed Rendell talking about this issue not recently, Michael.
Yes. It is a bipartisan issue. Who are these immigrants? They're the people who pick our fruits and vegetables. They're the people who prepare our food. They're the people who bus our tables. They're also the highly skilled people who came here and got graduate degrees and have started high-tech companies. And they're here. They're part of our economy. The question, what's happening now, I think, is figuring out how to harness that to the benefit of our economy instead of treating it like an alien force that needs to be expelled.
Well, and not to make broad generalizations, but it's you see farmers, you see construction projects, and Peter, you look and you think, well, I wonder how many people there are illegal immigrants.
Yes, many. It's a very leaky system of enforcement on the employer side. And this is something that drives the GOP, the restriction, as crazy, is that they see that the last bargain which was made, the last major legalization, was in 1986. It was a bargain on the one hand, a large-scale regularization. On the other hand, the idea was a crackdown on the employment side, and that clearly hasn't worked. And so they're in a situation of not wanting to be fooled a second time. So security, border security and enforcement, very clearly a key part of the package.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about immigration reform. There are some interesting debates going on over the legalization and a path to citizenship, some efforts reform here in the Pennsylvania area, and of course a discussion going on in Washington, D.C. Talking with Peter Spiro. He's the Charles Wiener Chair in International Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Michael Matza is the Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer on immigration. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY as part of the Strauss 150th Anniversary Year. Legendary pianist Emmanuel Axe joins the Philadelphia Orchestra to perform the youthful Burlesque, plus the first piano concerto of Johann Sebastian Bach. And Vladimir Yurovsky conducts Bach's Second Suite. Tickets online at philorg.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Emmanuel Axe, Vladimir Yurovsky, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
In the state,
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're in the middle of the membership drive here at WHYY. Yes, it's snowing outside, but that doesn't mean you can't take just a few minutes and become a member of WHYY. Make a pledge of support right now to ensure that WHYY and Radio Times remain strong and continue to serve you with the news and information that keep you in the know. What's that worth to you? $5, $10, $20 a month? Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Today, we're talking about an important issue, immigration, and what states are doing about it. And our guest is Mary Steed, whose mother worked at a notorious Magdalene laundry in Ireland and was forced to give her up for adoption. Mary was instrumental in getting the Irish government to apologize. That's what we do every day on Radio Times, keep you up to speed on events and introduce you to interesting people and ideas. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Michael Matza and Peter Spiro about prospects for immigration reform in the year 2014. Again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, you talked about border security, and I think it should be said that President Obama has overseen, he hasn't personally deported 2 million people, but he's overseen the deportation of something like 2 million undocumented immigrants since he's become president.
Right. So this administration has not been lax on immigration enforcement. In fact, many immigrant advocates are very unhappy about how tough on immigration enforcement the administration has been. I think President Obama recognizes that it's a necessary part, that border security is a necessary part of a deal. So he's been building up cred, basically, on that side of the equation as a way of smoothing the path to a reform package.
But are we talking about, you know, fences, people, surveillance, drones, all of that?
So in the Senate bill, I think $40 billion extra dollars would be thrown at border security, 700 additional miles of fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border, doubling the Border Patrol in terms of personnel. The Border Patrol has grown by a factor of 10 in terms of its budget since 1993. This is really enforcement theater, though. I don't think none of the policy experts on this see any real value to this. Even at the Department of Homeland Security, they're saying, well, we wouldn't know what to do with these kinds of resources. Wow. So it's all just by way of making the restrictionists happy enough with a package to move on legalization.
And Michael, I wonder how much are this country's economic problems and perhaps the fact that Mexico is a little better off than it was 10 years ago, how much that has affected illegal immigration across that border?
I think Mexico is a little bit better, and I think for a time we were a little bit worse. And so we were a less shiny magnet than we had been. But it's so complicated. When I deal with some of the local immigration groups here, they also not only want to talk about the very precise little specific things of the moment, but they want the big world picture of how NAFTA has created a system where we can sell our corn in Mexico cheaper than Mexican farmers can grow their corn, and that creates an incentive for farm workers who can't work in their own country to go find another place to work. I have these conversations that tend to get very global all of a sudden when we're initially talking about driver's licenses in Pennsylvania or some other issue.
But do you think that's a problem? I mean,
I think it is a problem.
The advocates for immigration reform? That it's too global and not sort of specific or focused enough?
No. I mean, I'm not sure I understand the question, Marty.
Well, I guess if people are lobbying for immigration reform but are talking about these large global issues, whether it makes it difficult to argue for something like a driver's license, for instance, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, no, I often find myself in conversation saying, while I acknowledge your global perspective is correct, we have to bring for most of the people in Pennsylvania, they want to know whether an undocumented immigrant is going to have a driver's license or not, and that's a much more ground truth kind of issue for them.
And is that an issue in Pennsylvania, the idea of a driver's license?
It is. There's some legislation that's being promoted in Harrisburg that would allow for that. There's two versions. One would be a specific license that identifies the driver as being an undocumented driver, and the other would be a license that looks just like anybody else's license. Two representatives are pushing this kind of legislation, but once again, there's a certain number of people in Harrisburg who are vowing to block it.
Licenses or IDs, is this a live issue, Peter?
Oh, I think it is. And you have many municipalities in other states in which this is being seriously considered and moved on. And I think it's a basic recognition that these people are members of our community. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to deny that. I mean, they're driving cars, so it's good that that be regulated. They're doing other things. They need to be able to cooperate with law enforcement. They need to they're here. Many of them have been here for many years. And so they're real members of the community, and that is in other states at least being recognized through these kinds of initiatives. And it should be recognized here.
I mean, is there any way, shape, or form 11 million people could be deported from this country?
Not a chance.
Not a chance. I mean, the
just looking at it from a budget perspective shows how ridiculous it would be. And the Republicans recognize that now, that there's not going to be a mass deportation of these people who, in many cases, again, have been here for many years and are members of our community.
What about the DREAM Act, which seems like people could get on board with that? These are the children of undocumented immigrants. You have to be in college or have a college degree or served in the armed forces. Why haven't we seen more, I guess, progress on this piece?
I think everybody's on board now with the DREAM Act and so the Republic, the principles on immigration reform that came out of the recent Republican retreat last week recognized the need to give that group a path to citizenship. And so it's just a question of where the opportunity is. Democrats don't want to do that as freestanding legislation. They want to make it a part of a bigger package. So that will happen with any package that is enacted. The problem is the rest of the package.
Whether you piece it out or make it part of the whole package.
An interesting wrinkle on that is that when the DREAM Act was on it, you know, they first introduced the DREAM Act probably 10 years ago in Congress, and year after year it just didn't go anywhere. Finally, in 2012, President Obama did something called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA. And that was a kind of executive way of recognizing that he would give 2 years of protection from deportation, a work authorization for these young people who came here with their parents. And he said in the State of the Union that he was – or in the run-up to the State of the Union, I think in the State of the Union itself, he was talking about using his powers, his own powers, to accomplish things if Congress would not. And in these principles that came out in Maryland last week, one of the principles was that we want the president to enforce the law. I mean, they're saying right up at the front, they don't want to see him doing a workaround like DACA was. And so it's – while I think we're all in agreement that all sides are recognize that these young kids who came here are blameless and they ought to be taken care of, there's still a lot of
pushback.
A lot of pushback.
Well, and I guess the question, Peter, is this just Congress doesn't want to pass anything or can't pass anything, or is there something about immigration that just makes it so hard to get consensus on?
Well, I think immigration is actually the one area where they would like to pass something, but there's so many moving parts, and the administration is not willing to accept a piecemeal approach. They're getting a whole package that's going to get the House on board is tough slogging.
Are you a betting man? I mean, do you think the House can come up with something that would make it through the Senate, it to Obama's desk?
So you've got this page-long principles from the Republicans. The devil is now in the details, and those details are pretty tough. So they're gonna want some certification of effective border security and other immigration enforcement as a trigger to legalization, and that's I think probably the next tough negotiating point.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, there's also talk among the Republicans that once we get into this, it's going to fracture our own party. We're going to have divisions within ourselves. Why don't we just stay together and fight the Affordable Care Act? You know, that we shouldn't take our eyes off the ball. Let's try and kill Obamacare, you know. And so I think that's one of the issues here, too.
Go ahead.
I think there's some recognition, though, that at the national level, Republicans really need this if they want to be competitive for the presidency.
Well, and after, I guess, losing in, what was it, 2012, I mean, there was some talk within the Republican Party that we have to figure out how to be more welcoming, I guess, of immigrants and illegal immigrants or undocumented.
So the leadership is really intent on pushing this through. It's the rank and file that's more skeptical.
Well, we are talking about immigration prospects for immigration reform in 2014 and talking with Peter Spiro. He's the Charles Wiener Chair in International Law, Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Also wrote a book a couple of years ago called Beyond Citizenship, American Identity After Globalization. Also with us, Michael Matza. He's the Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer on immigration, has been covering a lot of immigration issues here in the Commonwealth. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen with any questions or comments that you might have. Looks like we have Carol from Edgemont joining us on Radio Times. Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm wondering whether there is any country in the world besides the United States who allows a child born here to automatically be a citizen regardless of whether their parents are here legally or not.
Carol, let me see what Peter Spiro has to say.
So that's a very good question. And in fact, the United States is one of only a couple of states that has this absolute rule of territorial birthright citizenship. Basically, anybody who's born in the United States is a citizen at birth. There, Canada does have it, and there are some Latin American states that also have it. But it's I wouldn't say it's the norm. At the same time, that I think it's a pretty defensible approach to the issue. And even at the same time that there's been pretty intense anti-immigration sentiment, periodic proposals to scale back birthright citizenship through a constitutional amendment have really gone nowhere. And I think that's because the two issues are decoupled in the constitutional culture. And that's just sort of part of our constitutional tradition. And as set forth in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, that we have this rule of birthright citizenship.
But it's also part of our history, is it not?
Very much.
I mean, that sort of cements it.
It's been part of the process by which immigrants are assimilated, so that if an immigrant herself doesn't naturalize and acquire citizenship, which many don't, the children will and have. And so it's an automatic process for assimilation into the polity.
But it seems we even when you look at our history, we have a kind of ambivalent view of immigrants, I guess, in immigration. I mean, not always so welcoming in years past, not always so welcoming today.
It's a love-hate relationship.
It is. It feels that way.
We like to say we're the world in one country, you know, that we're a nation of immigrants and all of that. But as soon as our economy goes sour or some immigrant has committed a horrendous crime or something like that, suddenly there's an outcry to throw them all out.
We have an email from Richard. What purpose did the Reagan immigration reform bill of the 1980s serve, and did it accomplish anything? Why is it no longer relevant? But I guess it is the sort of law of the land, is it not? Or
it is. So the bargain in 1986, this was the Immigration Reform and Control Act, was a major legalization. So there had been this buildup, as we have now, of a large undocumented population. The bargain was legalization of that population at the same time that there would be increased enforcement in the workplace. And the problem is that the enforcement in the workplace hasn't worked out as planned, as we were discussing earlier. And so that's why the Republicans, it's sort of a fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me kind of situation from their perspective.
And they often point out that I think in 1986 there were something like 3.6 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. Now there's 11.7.
Yeah.
And so obviously something didn't work.
Do the chambers of commerce, are they interested in immigration reform and dealing with some of the issues that we've been talking about?
Certainly at the national level, I think the National Chamber of Commerce has supported the Senate's efforts, if I'm recalling.
I think they've gotten much more aggressive about it. It used to be much more behind closed doors, and now they're being very out front in terms of publicly advocating for immigration reform. They're, of course, interested in the legal immigration side of the picture, and so in the Senate reform package, there were guest worker provisions and some. But part of the thinking now is, well, we should make legal immigration match better with employer demand. And so that, I think, is part of the new framing of the problem.
Is that an issue in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's an issue in Pennsylvania. I think it's also an issue nationally in the sense that there's family-based immigration. We're going to reunify families. If you have family here and you're trying to come, that's one way. And then there's another way that's based on the skill set of the immigrant, that, you know, what do we need? Do we need more, you know, high-tech workers or do we, you know. And so there's a tension between two classes of immigrants, really,
right.
You know, and you know, socioeconomic classes of immigrants, and that's a tension in the pro-reform community, you know, in which they want to make sure that we don't just provide more visas for Silicon Valley, that we also recognize that people of lower skills who work in our McDonald's add to our economy and you know, are important for us.
The people who are picking crops, I guess, are the ones that might be
right.
curing cancer. I mean, to sort of
exactly.
show the two kind of, I guess, classes of immigrants. But does this country need immigrants? Do we need population, Peter? Do you know?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's crucial to economic growth. It's crucial to the country's future. I mean, that is part of our tradition. It's part of our history. It's part of our economic history. And so if we want to go forward in a very competitive global environment, then immigrants are absolutely a crucial part of the picture. And as things are now, we're scaring a lot of them away.
And I can imagine, Peter, Michael, someone listening to the show thinking, you know, they're going to take our jobs. You know, these are people that didn't come in here legally. Why are we being so generous to them?
Well, that is exactly the argument that they make. And, you know, as to the taking of jobs, I think in the farm industry, we know for sure they're not taking jobs. At the lower end of the job scale, there is some competition. There is no doubt there's competition. But the one of the arguments for legalizing immigrants is that they will have to be paid better wages. They won't be able to undercut wages. That it can actually stabilize the system right now, where people want to hire a roofer who's, you know,
not off
the books, and as opposed to a union roofer and so on and so forth.
You want to add to that, Peter?
Yeah, there are losers. Immigration does create losers, as globalization does generally, and those losses are felt more intensely than the gains, which are more diffuse over the population, and that makes it tougher to get these kinds of laws through, because there are those who feel like they're going to lose their jobs or they're going to be facing lower wages are, for perfectly rational reasons, mm-hmm. Going to more intensely fight these battles. So it's a really important part of the picture. And there are attempts to balance that out through training programs and other things, but it's tough.
And are we speaking largely people at the sort of lower end of the work?
Yes, absolutely.
Ladder?
Yeah, I think so.
Because of skills, I guess, and education and just what those jobs entail.
And the pie at that level is less likely to grow. When you're talking about more highly skilled immigrants, immigrant entrepreneurs, those are the immigrants that are going to be growing the pie and less likely to be directly competing with existing U.S. workers.
One example of how hot this issue is really is yesterday during the Super Bowl, the Coca-Cola ran an ad showing it was a multilingual, multi-ethnic ad using America the Beautiful and translating it into a lot of languages. It was quite beautiful, actually, when you watched it. But on Twitter, Twitter went wild with angry people, you know, who were saying, this is America. These ads should be in English. This is a desecration of America the Beautiful. It was really amazing to see the kind of hot reaction that it stirred up.
I'm going to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Michael Matza, who joins us along with Peter Spiro. We are talking about the possibility of immigration reform, what some of the sticking points are. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
I'm Marty Moscoane. It's the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and it's snowing outside. A perfect time and a perfect reason to be a member of your station for news and information. Think of what you hear every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You've got the BBC, Morning Edition, Radio Times, The Takeaway, Here and Now, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Newsworks Tonight, and that's just a partial list. And how about our newest program, The Pulse? We've done our job to bring you a diverse lineup of shows, something for everybody. Now it's time for you to do your part and become a member of WHYY to support the shows that you rely on and enjoy. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY, and you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We do this just a few times a year, a reminder that we could not do our jobs without your pledge of support. So make that call, make that pledge. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Last week, President Obama called on lawmakers at his State of the Union address once again to fix the country's broken immigration system. It's estimated that about 11 million undocumented immigrants are living in this country. The U.S. Senate and the House are at loggerheads over what to do about them, and states frustrated with inaction in Washington have been implementing some of their own immigration policies. We're talking about all of this with Peter Spiro from Temple University's Beasley School of Law, and Michael Matza, who's been covering immigration in Pennsylvania for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Before we get back to our callers, Peter, let me go back to you and just help us understand if you're an immigrant who wants to come to this country legally, what are some of the things that you have to do in order to be here legally?
Well, you have to qualify for a preference, either a family-based preference, that is, you have a qualifying relationship with an existing U.S. citizen or permanent resident alien that's defined mostly in terms of nuclear family, or you have to have, as Michael was pointing out earlier, a skill set that's in demand in this country. And then finally, you have two other sets. There are refugees and asylum seekers, those who would face persecution if they were returned to their homelands. And then finally, there are 50,000 visas allocated every year to the so-called diversity preference. This is the lottery for those who wouldn't otherwise qualify. But if you're not in one of those categories, you're out of luck. And even if you're in one of those categories, you may be facing a very long wait to immigrant status. And so that's one of the ways in which the current system is broken.
And long wait,
years. So in the sibling category of U.S. citizens, so brothers and sisters of U.S. citizens are eligible for preference. But in some cases, the wait is 25 years. So you better be a young sibling of a U.S. citizen, because it's going to be a very long time before you get it. So it's almost a theoretical eligibility for a green card status.
But why? Why 25 years?
Because they have a quota system that every year there are only a certain number of visas that are allocated for each of these categories. And for almost all of these categories, it's oversubscribed every year. And so this backlog has just kept building up over the years. So even for unmarried adult sons and daughters of U.S. citizens, there can be waits of as long as 10 or 12 years. And there are additional waits if you come from high immigration sending countries. So if you're from Mexico, the Philippines, India, or China, you face additional waits. And that's one of the reasons. So one thing that gets bandied about in these debates is, well, there are all these immigrants who have been waiting their turn in line. Well, it's a very long line. And a lot of them actually say, it makes no sense for me to wait 10 years to be with my parents, so I'm just gonna come in.
And, go ahead, Michael.
And Peter put that perfectly, and it's also not even one line. It's like multiple lines, really. And so this idea that everybody has to get to the back of the line before they're allowed any benefit, it's more complicated than the public realizes.
Is Pennsylvania a high immigration state, a low immigration state?
It's pretty low. I mean, the something like 6% of our population is foreign born. The nation as a whole is more like 12%. California is more like 40%. So, I mean, we're pretty low, frankly.
Is there a reason for that you know of?
Well, I'm not 100% sure. It's been changing. The gateways to immigration were traditionally into the big cities, and now there turns out that immigrants very often are going directly to the suburbs. You know, the inner ring suburbs where they can afford housing and places like that. But as to why, I think that we're an older state. We haven't had that much turnover, really, in terms of, you know, people. Turns out, I remember when I first moved to Pennsylvania and realizing so many people I met were born and raised here and stayed here.
You want to add to that, Peter, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Yeah, I think it's a metric, really, of economic health. The levels of immigration and the foreign born, and I'd say Pennsylvania probably is right there, sort of in the middle in terms of our economic prosperity. And it'd be nice if we could move that figure up. And immigrants are really the way to do it. So that I think it's important for people to understand these implications. That it's not just about dealing with people who are different than us. It's about making things better for all of us.
Because it would be good for the economy?
Absolutely. And certainly good. It's good. It's evidence of economic strength to have high levels of local immigration.
During the break, you mentioned the word Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Michael. And it'd be interesting to know sort of what that downtown, I guess, looks like today.
Well, I haven't been there too recently, but I was there back in the days when Lou Barletta was the mayor and it was a really hot-button issue nationally. And there was a downtown Main Street that was really revitalized by Dominicans primarily, who were moving down from New York because it was too expensive to live in New York. And they had new businesses. They had companies that, you know, sort of multi-service businesses that shipped packages overseas or had, you know, sold cell phone cards and all kinds of things like that. And people told me that downtown strip had been a ghost town until those people came.
And how about today? Because Hazleton hasn't been particularly welcoming to.
No, and I haven't been back recently, so I can't really speak to at this very moment.
Most of the Hazleton ordinance that passed very unfriendly to undocumented immigrants has been struck down in the federal courts now in the wake of a U.S. Supreme Court decision, which struck down most of SB 1070. But it does sort of bring home when you have this flight. Another example is Riverside, New Jersey, which had a community of Brazilians who had revitalized the downtown. When you pass these laws that are unfriendly to immigrants and then being rational, they leave, it does bring home sort of how important they can be to turning things around economically.
You can look at Woodland Avenue in Philadelphia, which was economically depressed for a long time. And because of African immigration, people from Ivory Coast and Senegal, there's a big revitalization that's going on out there.
You wrote a great piece about that.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Let me get to John from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, hi. Hi there. Marty. I've been interviewed a few times on immigration issues. I'm one of the beneficiaries of the law of the 1980 Refugee Act. I came in as a refugee about three decades ago. I know the history of this country. It's a country of immigrants. And for those questions that come out as if this nation is unique, having these law of birthright citizenship, you know, it's good to remind people this is a nation of immigrants. If we didn't have that law, how many percent of the current Americans would have been American citizens? That's a question that should be asked to people to remind them that the uniqueness of this nation. That uniqueness is what brought this nation to what it is today.
Well, John,
it's just a comment and a question.
No, I appreciate.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Just kind of underscoring, Peter, that we are a nation of immigrants.
Yeah, and this is another major reason in favor of the birthright citizenship rule, and that is that it avoids the risk of intergenerational caste. That, however, we deal with the parents who come here illegally, we're not going to visit their sins on their children who are born here. And so that, again, I think is why the move to scale back the birthright citizenship rule has gone nowhere. One thing that when we talk about the history, though, one interesting twist is that it's not clear that immigrants are going to be following the same assimilationist pattern that they did in the past. I mean, Michael mentioned the Koch ad, which is sort of an interesting reflection of the possibility that immigrant communities are going to maintain their distinctive identities in a way that wasn't true in the past. And that's also enabled by globalization to the extent that they can keep in touch better with their countries of origin. The communications are so greatly facilitated. Many really have sort of split lives between the United States and their countries of origin. And I think that's something that that antagonizes the sort of existing quote-unquote American community.
Sort of a countries within the country.
Exactly.
Creating their own culture within the country.
It's the classic difference between a melting pot and, a salad bowl or a goulash or whatever you want to call it. You know, there's chunks floating in that soup, and some people think that they ought to be rendered down into one uniform kind of American. And as Peter points out, our immigration of this century is different than it was back when our grandparents came to the United States.
But do you think that happens over time, that over generations people do assimilate?
Well, I think it's more of a question mark now than it used to be, because the diaspora connections are more enabled by modern communications. So I think it's not as clear that there's going to be the old model of assimilation is going to be prevalent among these new immigrant communities. At the same time, that studies show, for instance, that the rate of English language acquisition is very high among these communities. And just by being here, one can expect immigrant communities to sort of pick up whatever it is that it means to be American just from sort of physical proximity.
And just because you said something earlier, Peter, how does it benefit people, native-born Americans, if I can put it that way?
Well, I think a big benefit economically by tying into the global economy. I think it's also good to have this diversity of perspectives in all kinds of different ways at the ground level. It's better not to have a homogenous community, at the same time that it does stress, I think, the existing community. And Philadelphia is an interesting case. I'm also a newcomer to Philadelphia. It does have a somewhat insular quality to it. And so that may result in this resistance to difference. But ultimately, I think it makes us all stronger in our own identities.
Michael.
Yeah, I think the thing to remember is they're makers as well as takers, these immigrants, and that they arrive here relatively young during the height of their working years. They have higher fertility rates, and so they're replenishing our population they're slowing the aging of America. They're offering people who would participate in our social security system and help keep that solvent. And there are a lot of pluses, actually, that immigrants bring.
And do you find in Harrisburg that this issue has, I guess, more legs, this whole issue of immigration, and how do we address this immigration within our borders?
They make the point that we may not be a border state, but that doesn't mean we're not affected by what goes on. And I think that point is well taken. There are some people who can be counted on to
disagree,
push back, and believe that this is an illegal alien invasion, and that the moment someone enters the United States or enters illegally or overstays a visa, it sets them down the road to doing other illegal acts, and that it's terrible for us.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Michael Matza, who joins us along with Peter Spiro. And we're talking about the prospects for immigration reform this year or beyond. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Peter, you wanted to add something.
Well, I think it's really too bad that we don't roll out the red carpet for immigrants in Pennsylvania. And think about this as a competitive atmosphere among states. And we should want to attract these makers, as Michael puts it. And so to the extent that we send unfriendly signals to them, they'll go someplace else where they're going to be where they're going to be welcome. And that will ultimately be to our detriment.
And a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye, but I'm interested in the this Republican proposal, series of proposals. Do you think, Peter, that that will be more than just a, you know, a couple of days intellectual exercise that the Republicans went through, or do you think that there can be some movement on this
issue? Well, I think there's a lot of activity here, and the principles is the fact that the Republicans were able to agree on the, on these principles is an important milestone on the way to securing reform. But again, the details, it's so sprawling in undertaking comprehensive immigration reform, and there's so many details that need to be worked out that I wouldn't be betting I wouldn't be a betting man on this quite yet.
And what do you think John Boehner has to do, Michael Mazza, well, to get this, get some movement on this?
Well, a couple of months ago, he hired a woman named Rebecca Talent. Rebecca had worked for John McCain. Rebecca has a great history on immigration issues, and she came over from the Bipartisan Policy Center. And when that happened, people saw that as kind of a bellwether, that she wouldn't have come and Boehner wouldn't have hired her if he wasn't serious about trying to make it happen. Others have other members of his own party have said, well, if he wants to make that happen, there goes his speakership. You know, it's like he might as well just, you know, fall on his sword, you know, to accomplish this issue. Maybe he will. I don't know.
I mean, in a sense, staking his reputation perhaps on this particular issue.
Yeah. I mean, but it's complicated because, you know, surveys have shown that to the American public at large, immigration is not the top of the priority list, that the economy and putting people to work is the top of the economy. And in fact, immigration falls around 16 on a list of 20.
Wow. Is it on top of your list, Peter?
Well, it's certainly on the top of the list of Hispanic voters. And so, again, at the national level, the leadership of the Republican Party recognizes how important this is. But leadership in political parties isn't what it used to be. And just because John Boehner wants it to happen doesn't mean that it will.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times, for getting here through the snow. And Peter Spiro, thank you very much.
Always glad to be here, Marty.
And always glad to have you. Michael Mazza, thank you very much as well.
Honored to be here.
And he's the Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer on immigration. Peter Spiro is the Charles Wiener Chair in International Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And again, you can follow us on Twitter at Marty Moscoane. I am Marty Moscoane, and stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.